The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now it's time for the Friday Forum and to look back at some of the big stories of the week. I'm joined by Niamh Smith, Fianna Fáil TD for Monaghan and North Meath, Party spokesperson on Arts, Culture and Heritage, Gary Gannon, Dublin Central TD for Social Democrats, Party spokesperson on everything, Gary. Education, higher education, arts, social protection, foreign affairs and defence, and Daniel McConnell, who's in charge of being editor of the Irish Business Post. You're very...
Thank you, Pat.
And now, leaving cert, memories of today.
So Kilmacud, St. Benilda's College, went down with a couple of pals. I was kind of relatively lucky. I knew I wanted to do arts in UCD, but pressure, I wanted to do journalism. But the advice I got from my career guidance teacher was don't do a journalism degree because it's a waste. You'd waste 4 years doing that. Go in and do a primary degree, do it arts or do commerce. So I had a huge interest in history and politics. So arts was about 390. So the pressure was kind of off. I did a reasonably good mocks, so I knew I didn't really have to sweat that.
You didn't sweat it at all?
No, I was rather... Now, the only thing that really annoyed me was I didn't get the A in history, which I wanted. I got the B1, which I was...
But that didn't impact on your eligibility?
No.
So I think Kieran Cuddy offended everybody in South Dublin. He said all you had to do to get a degree from UCD was drive in the back gate in Clonskea and out the front gate in...
Well, I was your classic County Dublin person, so it wasn't quite that easy, but yeah, it was a bit of that. But no, I mean, it was a day of great joy, I think, for a lot of us, because we were a real catchment school of in Kilmacud going down to UCD. It was a huge number of us who went down, be it into engineering or into commerce or into arts. So there was a good gang of us who all, you know, and I remember Arlop, we all pretty much got what we wanted. So now very few of the guys who went into engineering, they were all gone by about 6 weeks into it. They didn't stick with it. Those of us who went into arts did stick with it. So it was great.
Yeah, I mean, arts is really the drinking degree, isn't it?
I know, stop. We had a lot of reading time, Pat, I think.
Gary.
Pubble School, Rosminion, 2005, up in Drumcondra. But I'd actually started my apprenticeship as a plumber over in Griffith College. So I wasn't able to get off until about 1 o'clock. So I got off at 1 o'clock and kind of made my way over to the school and done okay. Like, I mean.
And what was the atmosphere like? Can you remember? Was there a hubbub? And
well, everyone was planning their night out. Like, so, I mean, I wasn't planning on the life going to college. I'd been kind of set up for leaving cert, or before leaving cert, my dad set me up as a plumber apprenticeship. So I had that, happened to be working over in Griffith College. So went over. I got an A in English, which I was very happy about. Yeah. I did not get an A in maths, I can assure you, or anything else. And then about 8 months later, I was let go from my apprenticeship because that was the economy at the time. Yeah. And I just happened to be working in Griffith College where I was looking at people my age drinking tea and coffee while I was carrying radiators. And I was like, I wouldn't mind a bit of that. So I hadn't thought about college when I was doing my leaving cert.
That's a great story because now we're trying to persuade more people to do apprenticeships. As you know, there's a rate of attrition and yet... one person was telling us about, you know, you get an arts degree and your job might earn you X. You get a trade and you might be earning triple X.
You might be, but I also may, I remember thinking all lads on my football team, I think everybody got a trade around that time. There was a lot of building going on. I'm not sure many ended up sticking there. It was also the first part to go. I mean, and I was not said, I have no capacity. I get splinters pointing at things like I'm not a practical man. But I never would have known about university or colleges and that unless I had been working on one. So
Can't be it if you don't see it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it.
Niamh, what about your leaving cert?
Pat, can I just start off by just reminding you that I'm actually in the constituency of Cavan Monaghan because I know the Cavan listeners listening in this morning might be disappointed. But just to say, I did the Leaving Cert in Bailiwick Community School. I do remember very well, clearly, the Leaving Cert results day. It kind of sends shivers down my spine too. But I had actually wanted to go to NCAD to do art teacher training and I had already been accepted before the Leaving Cert results came out. So it wasn't kind of a points game at that stage to get into NCAD. It was all about your portfolio, your interview, and then you had to have your leaving cert.
And you were in there
you.
Already.
I was in. So it was
great.
So
we've got
three
people who never sweated at all.
I wouldn't say I didn't sweat. Of course I did, but it was a great relief to get it over and under your belt.
Now we're going to stay with education because Norma Foley's idea that you can ban smartphones from secondary schools and how that might work. What say you, Danny?
Yeah. So this is a burning issue because my eldest is now 11. She's going into fifth class.
Does she have a smartphone?
No. And we've sort of resolved that she won't get a smartphone until she goes into, or won't get a phone until she goes into secondary school.
But Dad, Siobhan has one.
I know. And that's the battle that we're fighting. And we've already had that discussion. So, you know, a couple of our friends have got these things called call watches, basically that their parents can ring them. Yeah. At only specific numbers can make contact. We've not gone there, yet, but like, I see the dangers, we see the pitfalls. I mean, I even see her, she's already, when she picks up my smartphone and my phone,
she's pretty good at it.
She's in it, and but like, it just draws her in. It's no more than if you give them the iPad or you give them the tablet. It just draws them in, and it can be very hard to extricate them out. I have this fear that, you know, my children are at the stage where they're all about us, and they're you know, in our faces, and they're, it's great. You see the screens coming in, and they'll disappear into their own, they'll disappear into their rooms very quickly. And so I think that it's a laudable, I think, idea to try and ban them, because I think the longer you delay the access to smartphones, the better, because of all the dangers that are there. But it would take a lot of, I think, policing from, and I think the effectiveness is in the policing from parents and from teachers and the principals, and whether or not you get alignment all across the board, that's the difficulty.
Niamh?
I think it's a great idea. I think it'll be doing a huge service for parents and teachers. I know that a lot of schools are already trying to minimise the amount of screen time or the usage of phones at all in schools. And sometimes it's probably a battle between teachers and parents. No, my child needs to have a phone because I need to be able to contact them and so on. So I think the minister taking this step is something that would be welcomed overall by schools and
parents. There is a suspicion that it might be a pre-election kind of promise, but the reality of implementation and getting buy-in from principals, from teachers, and from the secondary school students themselves, they have to, it really has to be from them that they see that this is not the best way to be living, you know, being bullied or whatever.
I think everybody already accepts that, to be honest, Pat. And I think that ambiguity at the moment, as it is, whether you can or you can't have it, and nothing sort of format or formal in place for schools and teachers and principals in particular, must make life particularly difficult to try and manage all that. Because we know so much of the bullying and the toxic behaviour that Danny was talking about happens on phones, and it can be very isolating for kids. I think it'll be giving the students a great break as well from social media.
Gary?
Yeah, and I don't to dismiss anything that's been said previously. I think there's huge conversations to be had about smartphones and access to social media in particular for younger people. But I question whether this is actually the remit of Norma Foley, and as to whether she doesn't have actually more important things she should be focusing on. I mean, when you think of the issues that come up when I'm talking to school principals every day, it's teacher shortages, it's the absence of ASD units. I mean, the idea that the Minister for Education focuses on a ban as if this is like something for her office to celebrate, rather than that be the remit of the Department of Children. I mean, there are significant issues.
Is she not responding, though, to the concerns of parents like Danny?
The board of management are already responding to those issues. These issues are already happening in schools as we speak. And I mean, if you have a ban, you also have to have enforcement. And what's the department actually saying they're going to do with little Johnny, who's 14, has given up a fake phone and still has his phone in his pocket, which is going to happen? I mean, I don't doubt for a second there is huge issues to be in relation to bullying.
I mean, we hear talk during the week about kids with burner phones. It sounds like criminals, you know.
But this is kids going to be this will like. But this is not something that won't happen. We are talking about teenagers, like, and these phones are going to be a part of their life. I mean, education should be about just that. It's about how we educate, how we inform, how we empower. I mean, the idea of a ban. Look, I think it's already happening, but there's no legislation coming through on this ban with it. This is literally just rhetoric to a point. There's going to be guidance to schools.
Danny?
Yeah, like, so I sit on the board of management of an infant boys school in the inner city. So this isn't really, it's not a burning issue. But to Gary's wider point, I mean, the school runs at a shortfall every year. You know what I mean? The state funding isn't enough to run the school. So we have to fundraise every year just to keep the lights on. So that is a real issue. Like, so there is a criticism there that the system isn't funded properly. I do think, though, I think it sends an important message to schools or parents who are looking to try and get some guidance here. Because they're fighting this kind of, maybe they're fighting against
the tide. Would it help you as a parent to say no?
I think, like
you know, the minister says you can't have a smartphone until you're leaving third year, you know, fifth year, whatever. Therefore, you're not getting one.
I think it embeds a culture, or certainly signals a culture, that the school is not going to tolerate. I think we saw the example of Greystones a couple of years ago, where the parents in the school took a decision not to allow the phones in the school. Whether it's practical all the way up to sixth year, it may be up to junior cert level, and you might relax a little bit. That might be the solution that a lot of people. But I think ultimately, you know, from a school's perspective, the principal should have discretion, I think, ultimately, to make a bespoke solution for their individual. Because I do think a one size fits all thing can be a bit crude and may not work. As Niamh said, in rural schools, if the phone is the only means of communication when lifts are needed, so there are extenuating circumstances, but ultimately...
We had a text during the week about someone who's on Dexcom for type 1 diabetes, which talks to a smartphone.
Yeah.
And that child would need
that smartphone. There will be exceptions, but I think ultimately, I think overall, the idea of saying smartphones in schools, around schools, limits the potential for bullying and antisocial behaviour, or the sort of really horrible stuff that we hear teen. And my big fear as my kids enter their teenage years is the sort of stuff they could be facing into. If there's a thing to try and stop it, then I would welcome it.
Yeah, but there's also conversations beginning elsewhere about like banning for social media companies will enable children under the age of 14, for example, to access social media. I mean, they're trying that in parts of Australia. It's been talked about in the UK at the minute. That for me would be something that would have actually more of an impact than just a guidance from the department to schools and seeing that as something to celebrate when we have so much more important issues to be focusing on within those spaces.
Can I just say, to Gary's point, I do agree with that, but I do think giving guidance is important for principals and teachers in schools, and it also supports parents who are, because I'd say the vast majority of parents do want their kids, you know, not consistently having the screen in front of them and that extra pressure that phones bring, whether it be on their
social media
platforms.
Before the calls come in, I can tell you what they're going to say. Kids can't buy a smartphone without money. Mm. Who gives them the money?
Completely.
So, anyway, most schools have banned phones already, says one. My kids have attended three schools, none allowed smartphones. Yeah. Norma needs to concentrate on shortage of teachers, the shortage of places, autistic students, etc. Sick of hearing about mobiles when there's far bigger fish to fry. Deflecting from the real issues at hand is so frustrating. That's Gary's point, I suppose. Phones to go into lockers for the day. Teachers haven't the time to be policing this. Any incidents that happen outside school hours, not school business. Smartphones should not be banned. Their children should be educated on their use. An educational system should educate. That's from Tommy. My daughter's school already does this. High pass time to ban phones for under 16. More dangerous than cigarettes, according to Simon. The second you give your child a phone, they are lost to the online world. No matter how hard you try as a parent to monitor and police the use, it's an ongoing argument in the household, especially when you have several teenage children of slightly different ages within the same family. Just survey the parents. I'm sure the majority would say ban schools altogether, phones from schools. And a final one, a different topic, vaping as big and dangerous an issue. We shall move on. We'll go back in time now to childcare and the calls from SIPTU and from the National Women's Council, Niamh, for a state-funded, not state-run childcare rather than state-funded, state-run childcare system. What do you say? Isn't it about time?
I do agree. I do agree. For years, I have felt myself that, you know, that particular cohort of young children that are coming into our education system, like we do provide a really good primary state-run primary care, or primary setting, and then secondary as well. And I do think there is a very strong argument for a state-run early childhood years programme within the country. Are we trying to get there? I would argue we are, Pat, to be honest with you. I think that that is probably where the government would like. I mean, Roger O'Gorman, we're coming to the end, I suppose, of a government cycle. But I would think when you look at state at core funding and how it has been implemented, the things that have been done to try and create more places, the measures
then,
have been
then the core funding, you get so much in core funding, and then the providers are allowed to increase their fees by the core funding, so it saves the parents nothing.
I hear that, and I know you've been discussing this quite a bit during the week as well. I suppose my point really is I would agree that, you know, in the long term, I would like to see that the state would provide the early years childhood education setting as well. It's a difficult tightrope because you've a lot of people who are running businesses. I'm thinking maybe more of the rural settings. You're probably more focused on the urban settings. And it's to get the balance right that that the state is supporting those who are providing that service and equally not putting people
the
out of business.
The state is currently laying down the employment rules, the ratios and everything else, the qualifications that are required. So the state is actually controlling a lot of the activity.
It's definitely more involved,
and is not taking on the responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Danny.
So again, burning issue. My youngest has just finished in preschool. She starts in school movie now next week.
So you have loads of money to spend.
So the whole idea of childcare has been a second mortgage to us over the last number of years. Like it's really expensive. My big fear about the state getting involved: the state is really bad at running stuff. It's really bad at running big
schools.
Projects. But the schools have been there since time immemorial. But like in more recent times, the state is generally crap at managing money, managing big budgets. And rarely effectively, you talk to childcare providers all over the country, as we have done. They talk, the amount of money coming in per capita is insufficient to try and deliver the sort of services that they need. you know, it gets bogged down in bureaucracy, you know, like it just, the money doesn't get to where it needs to get to effectively enough. I would have a real, that it just becomes another gaping black hole of money and waste and bureaucracy and all the rest of it. It doesn't serve the industry, which is essentially run by private operators. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't get this.
No, my vision in my head is that you have a primary school, they're building a lot of them, expanding. And over in the corner, you have the preschool.
Yeah.
And you've got people who are paid, same pay and conditions, same holidays.
Yeah.
Well, they can't quite have the same holidays if you're working through the summer.
Yeah.
Because you've got parents are still working, even though the kids might be off.
Yeah.
But in the corner of that site, you have
your Nina, or you have your preschool. And that makes an awful lot of sense, because you mean, from a parent's perspective, it's one drop as opposed to two. It makes the after-school option, if that's the one you're looking
at. It's a seamless transition.
Seamless transition, absolutely. But again, just going back, my experience over many years of looking at how the state does things, it tends to do things really, really badly and really slowly. So I wouldn't have great confidence in the state backing stuff up.
We've managed the state to this point, Annie, but we all believe in better. But I would argue that the system as it is at the moment is a reflection of the state throwing good money into a place where we're actually not really seeing the benefit of this point. And you see that reflected in North Dublin this week, where nearly 600 parents were told that they had to increase their childcare payments by 60 or 80 euro per child. Look, we do need to get to a model where the state does take ownership of early years education, and it actually needs to be seen not just as childcare or a holding facility. It has to be early years education. We should start that in this budget or next.
You know, we always say, well, we should have done, and
we shouldn't start from
the
here.
The only time to start is now.
So actually in this budget, and you'll see this, and I'm going to get a plug in, you'll see this in the show, Democrats pre-budget submission, will be some infrastructural money for purchasing of childcare facilities to come under state ownership, because that is how you start it. It doesn't happen overnight, but we do need to start now by purchasing the infrastructure, because at the moment, huge state money going in, we're getting poverty wages, and we still have exorbitant fees.
Okay, now, staying with Danny's point about the state, the health service, and the report that emerged from health department officials that the public aspect of our health system is less efficient in productivity terms than the private.
Yeah, so Stephen Donnelly did an interview with Daniel Murray in our paper last weekend, calling out the lack of productivity in the health service.
And in some consultants, it actually went down.
Yeah.
Productivity went down.
So again, it goes back to, like, we have seen the budgets for the HSE and the health sector balloon. It has doubled over the last 10 or so years. Are we getting twice the health service we were getting 10 years ago? No, we're not.
Inflation, medical inflation as well as ordinary inflation, and an increasing population.
Get all that, and I think those points are valid. What I don't get is the endless waste of money in terms of, you know, we know the system is overly managerial in terms of the level of managers in the system. We know the integration to a centralised HSE has utterly failed. So that's why they've gone back to a sort of health board sort of system. We know there's no financial control or adequate financial control, because we hear the likes of Pascal Dunne, who is public expenditure minister, pull his hair out every summer at this time because they can't get a control of what the numbers are like in the health service. So time and time again, we've had successive governments utterly fail to get the house in order in terms of get control. Now, I think Bernard Gloucester is doing...
What is the problem? Because one of the people like John Crown advocate, money follows the patients.
Yeah.
In other words, the more you do, the more operations you do, the more electives or necessary surgeries, the more money you get. Instead, there's budgets attached to hospitals, and when they run out, they just say, give us more.
Yeah, so you've got that issue, but also as well, I think, you know, from a ministerial perspective, they say, well, listen, any discussion around budgets, 80% of the budget is taken up by pay. So, you know, like the room to actually manoeuvre is limited, you know, in terms of being able to actually affect change. But we've never seen, in my lifetime, writing about politics or writing about the state, have I seen a minister deliver what I would consider a comprehensive or radical plan that would actually change the health service. We tinker around the edges.
Yeah.
And most ministers say, I can't tackle the big thing. So Stephen Donnelly is yet again, he has made some progress in terms of women's health. He's made some progress in terms of delivering kind of, but these are relatively minor issues, and the main thrust of the HSE has remained unaffected.
Yeah. But don't forget that the experts advising the ministers, and you know, how few of them have been doctors over the years or any kind of medical professionals, Leo being an exception, the same experts are advising each minister, no matter who they are.
And also
people within the department, they don't change.
And we've also seen a throughput of ministers flip every 2 to 2.5 years. Stephen Donnelly's probably the first health minister to last a full term. So we've always had this kind of churn of ministers over and over again.
The education process that's necessary for each new minister, Niamh.
I do think that productivity is hugely important in every walk of life. Whether you're a teacher in school, we all like to see students doing well, and it reflects on the teacher. The same in the health service, like productivity is important. And I don't think that there has been enough emphasis on that up to this point. And your point about that report that shows that those in the private hospital are, you know, achieving or getting through greater numbers, and the minister's idea, I suppose, that productivity is now weighed up against the investment, public investment that goes into hospitals, I think is a step.
He's saying no more. If you don't deliver, you're not getting any more money.
I think that's a step in the right direction. And I think, you know, it can't continue to be the begging bowl or the real drain that has been on the budget, because if you're in education or transport, there's always a bottom line. But with the health service, it seems to be, you know, we've run out, we need more, and they always need a bailout.
But I think productivity. It's life and death. That's
Well, exactly.
Gary, I still believe that we all very much are signed up and committed to what would be a radical plan for healthcare, which is the Sláintecare report, which crazily is actually 7 years into its existence.
The department don't want it.
The department don't want it, but actually the public want and the public need it, and that should have to
be delivered. And it is being delivered. Like, I mean, can I just say, for example, in Cavan Monaghan, like in the last year, we've opened 3 primary care centres, and they are in very rural constituents, parts of the country like Kilishandra, Clonus, Monaghan, and they are kind of providing that really community care piece.
What kind of hours are they open? This
is. Well, I can't honestly say to you, but they're probably Monday to Friday. It is happening, and you see these state of the art buildings open with the services in them, where they have their GP, where they have their OT, where they can go to have their newborn babies looked after, and they are making a big difference. And I just to
back
pick to up
the
on
future,
Danny's
the
point,
old dispensary.
Well, to pick up on Danny's point, he said about women's healthcare. Women's healthcare for decades has been completely ignored. And in fairness to Minister Stephen Donnelly, he has revolutionised. He has put menopause clinics in place, something that was never talked about. IVF, fertility treatment
free. Yeah, but
each
minister has always gone for their own little
pet project.
Achievement. Yeah.
But Michael Noonan on cancer care. 51% of the population are women, and all of these particular clinics and hubs never existed before his term in government.
What about CAMHS though?
I know, absolutely. There are always examples where it's not achieved, and I don't take away from that, but not to dismiss the things that have been achieved.
Finally, we should ask you about your take on the Democratic National Convention. What did you think, Danny?
Yeah, so I think the exit of Joe Biden and the arrival of Kamala Harris and Coach Walz, as he's been referred to, you know, has obviously energised the Democratic base. We've seen the funding has obviously, you know, has come in and restated. It makes it a far more interesting election from my perspective rather than watching two old men kind of go at each other. I think the balance of the Democratic ticket, you know, it's so blatant. They needed to balance Kamala Harris. They needed a white man, gun-toting coach, football coaching, to kind of try and get that middle ground. Donald Trump, I think, has looked more frail since Joe Biden has exited. I think he's looked less sure-footed and has made an awful lot of mistakes. But there's that core vote that will stick with him. It's just whether or not Kamala Harris and Tim Walz can get the swing.
And that core vote was about 46%, which is probably where Kamala Harris is as well. So, I mean, there's still a lot to play for. It's really interesting to see Donald Trump and the likes so rocked by someone who just simply wants to laugh at them and doesn't take them seriously and doesn't respond. I think it's a really interesting approach. I think it's made a difference. There is very much energy in the campaign, those swing states. But you also have to remember there's a lot of new voters into the mix that weren't there 4 years ago. A lot of those are going to be a lot more progressive, and a lot of Donald Trump's voters probably have moved on as well. So, I mean, the Democrats are not in as bad a position as we would have thought a couple of weeks ago.
And Niamh, from your point of view, you know, going into an election, and people, when you have loads of promises, they say, why didn't you do that when you started 5 years ago? Do you know what I mean? That's what Kamala Harris is stuck with from Trump.
Yeah, I think probably her biggest disadvantage is she has been sort of very much in the background for the last 5 years.
Deliberately and so, it would appear.
Possibly, but you could also argue maybe she's the bright, new, shiny thing that they needed. But what I'm really happy about is to see that the real issues are being discussed. It is a proper campaign now. It's not that slagging match that it's been up to now. And I think it's really important for the world.
Absolutely. All right, just a couple of comments to finish. I work for the HSE. OMG, such waste is unbelievable. Private would run it for 50% of the cost with 33% of the staff. Waste. And someone else wants to point out that preschool teachers do not have the same paying conditions as primary school teachers. Far from it. That's from Linda. I know that. I was suggesting that they would my vision of the Nina in the corner of the site.
Are you standing for election then, Pat? Yeah,
I have more sense. Anyway, some broadcasters, though, have thrown their hat in the ring.
Absolutely.
All right, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Gary Gannon, to Neil Smith and to Daniel McConnell.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.